Hello, everybody.
After.
There comes Phil.
Here I am. Hello.
Hi, Phil.
Hello, Phil.
Hey.
Hi.
So what have you guys been talking about? I always feel like I miss out on something because I know this conversation, and then I come on and everything stops. So let me in. What's been going on?
Let me ask you, Phil. How are you?
Oh. I'm fantastic. Thank you for asking.
Oh, okay.
It's not better.
Well, I am better. I am better.
Okay.
I had a little, I don't know, you know, when you asked, I didn't know if you were asking because you knew, but I had a detached retina. So
yeah.
I went through.
They all know.
Yeah,
they
you all
know.
Knew. So, you know, I'm kind of in this recovery phase, and it's a really weird thing. But yesterday, for the first time, I was able to see my eye with my eye, which doesn't sound like much, but, you know, every day I wake up and I go, can I see through it? Can I see through it? And yesterday I went to the mirror and I'm like, wow, I could see my eye. So, yes, I am better, and that should have been my answer. But I also feel fantastic because it's just a great feeling to know that I am better. So I'm both. I'm better and fantastic.
Right.
Now, what did I miss?
We were talking about somebody else had a detached retina, too, and then we were talking about the seminar.
Is that true?
Dr.
Somebody
Black.
Else had a detached retina?
Dr. Black.
Yeah, I had it. I had a year ago, I know what you're talking about. When my bubble started to get smaller, I started to be able to see.
Yeah. Did you have to lay face down?
5 days, yep.
Was that crazy? I mean, crazy in terms of you don't realize how difficult it is, I think, psychologically to not see another person's eyes, right? To not be able to look somebody in the face. So, yeah you
horrible.
Get it. You get it. Okay, what else? Other than retinas, let's move on past the retinas. What else were we talking about?
We were talking about the seminar, and I had raised my prices to the Black Pearl price with the functional medicine and up to $1,200 for TCD.
Fantastic. Love that. What else? And the reason I'm asking is, just so you guys know, when I talk to Sarah after the call, she'll go, I don't know why they weren't more talkative, because before the call they were all talking, and then when you come on, they stop. So that's what I'm trying to kind of extract it now. So you raised your prices up to the Black Pearl price. That's fantastic. What else? That's it?
That's as far as we got.
Yeah.
Okay, Sarah, anything else?
Yeah, and well, Dr. Jim was just starting to chime in when you came on. So.
Okay. Hello, Dr. Jim.
Hello.
Didn't mean to step on your chiming.
No. Mm-mm.
All right, so today we're going to talk about rituals, and a very specific ritual, and that's the intention, the plan of today's call. But I want to start off sort of looser. I want to really kind of wing it a little bit. And I'm really curious, and I just want you to answer honestly. I know sometimes I ask questions, and you guys are tentative because you think there's like a trick to the question. You don't want to give the wrong answer. But why do we need seminars? I will tell you, having been through many industries and speaking in many events, you know, nobody's better than Papa. Honestly, I mean, whoever he surrounds himself with, he just has such a great, genuine impact on people. But why do we need it? And before you answer it, I want to tell you that I've been to many motivational seminars in my life and sales seminars and, you know, huge seminars where it's in a big arena. And what I find is people walk out pumped up and driven and motivated, but it doesn't last. So why do we need it? Is it sort of like a booster shot? Why do you think we need these seminars? And I'm acknowledging that we do. So why? What do we really get out of it?
I think it's, you know, around like-minded people.
Okay.
That's one of the things. I mean, again, this seminar was different than April's much, and I'm really happy about that. I mean, a lot of extra stuff and great information, but being around people that have that same process, that same thought process on again health and, you know, charging people for getting well, et cetera. It's nice to be around that. I think there's something that comes from that almost on a spiritual standpoint, where you're around these people that are, you're not going it alone. There's people out there in the world, you know, that think what you think.
Good. Now, would you say that plays a role in elevating your belief system? Because in a microcosm, in your own universe, you know, you decide what you want to charge, you decide what you want to do, but then you don't really see other people doing it. So is this validating in that sense, that it kind of encourages the belief? Because, yes, there are other people doing exactly what I aspire to do and doing it well.
Yes,
is that a piece?
Yes, because my goal was to try to get everybody to charge more for TCD when I was there. charge
okay.
charge the you know. So anyway, because it's completely worth that.
Good. So the black pearl, in essence, the black pearl is the relative value that somebody's got to set the value, and now all of a sudden, if people believe that's the value, there it becomes. So being around mm-hmm. like-minded people sort of cements that yes, it's worth it, and yes, I can charge that. Good. Why else do we need seminars? It's got to be more.
I think otherwise, you get refocused.
What's that?
It helps me get refocused. You know, it kind of clears all the crap away that builds up over the year or 6 months or whatever. And, you know, you kind of recharge and get focused again.
Okay, because it's 2 or 3 days immersed in it rather than having all of the distractions that take place when you're in your own world.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else? There's got to be more. You get refocused. It reinforces your belief. You're around like-minded people. What else?
It's good to see other people being successful.
Okay. Where's the part about learning? Why wasn't that first? Why wasn't the first thing because we get educated because we learn stuff?
For me, that wasn't the most important thing, I guess.
Right.
Well,
I'm agreeing with
you. I learned too. I learned some new stuff too, but I think everybody on this call probably knows enough to help people get well, and that's a byproduct. Like I did, I was like, "Ooh, that was a great nugget. Ooh, I'm going to use that, or I'm going to tweak that." But it's everything that goes along with it.
Right, and you could probably get that same little nugget just spending an hour or two flipping through YouTube videos, right? Or old, you know, sell TV shows. You can still get those little nuggets. So that's not really the main reason you go. What's interesting is the main reason you go is for a reinforcement of belief, a sense of connection, to be around like-minded people.
I think there's the vibration, especially from the speakers, but also from the other attendees. It's like, you know, one of the things that Dr. Pompa talks about all the time in the seven habits to be successful, seven habits to lose value and gain value, is that the five people that you hang around the most, and I think that at seminars we get the opportunity to hang around other people that are, you know, either where we're at, above where we're at, or, you know, and that helps a lot.
Okay. Good. So we need that. We need that. You know, we can be as confident as we pretend to be in a moment, but sometimes we need to be around other people to validate, to feel that sense of connection, to feel like we're not going it alone, to feel like we're part of a collective. Even though we're in our own universe, we are, in fact, an individual. So I'm going to throw another question out there. I want you to think about it. I want you to be honest. I asked this once before in a different way, but do you feel almost unfairly overshadowed by the MD, by the conventional medical field? Do you sometimes just want to stomp your feet and just say, I can't believe all of these people are devoting all this money and all this time and all of this belief to the conventional medical field that is not getting them well? Do you feel that?
Yes.
Next sure.
Is there any level of resentment, and there's no shame in that, is there any level of resentment? Because the truth is, any one of you at any point could have gone back to school to become an MD, and then you could have become the maverick MD, where you do things differently. So is there some level of resentment where you go, hey, it's just not right, it's just not fair? Or do you just sort of own it and go, this is who I am, and this is my responsibility, and it does frustrate me, but so be it?
Yeah, I try not to focus on it. I just try to focus on what I can do and not worry about, you know, if someone decides, you know, they're going to switch from me and go to a medical doctor because they said, you know, our supplements are made from, you know, dirty water or something.
Right. What I find interesting is if we would sit an MD and a DO and a health coach and a chiropractor at a table and say, what is the bottom line of what you guys do? Everybody would say, we help people get well. But I find it really interesting that I've been to a lot of conferences. I've spoken at a lot of conferences, many medical conferences, at your groups. I don't see MDs and chiropractors sitting side by side at these conferences. Occasionally, you know, two MDs in a room of 60 chiropractors or vice versa. But typically, they're not. There is a division. There is a division. And I do sense, and perhaps a justifiable resentment. So I said, I'm going to kind of go off the program a little bit because I'm aware of this. And I just want to examine it a bit in terms of value, because you started talking about value and the black pearl and what you're going to charge. And a part of the resentment has to be not only the reverence people hold for doctors, not that there's anything wrong with that, but should it be at least equal if you're able to get people well? And also the financial element of it, that don't you deserve to be making what they're deserving, what they're making, because I don't know that doctors have as many conferences and coaches and groups that help them with their income. They have different types of focuses, but not a whole lot really focused on increasing your income. So are you guys familiar with the caduceus? Does anybody know what that is, the caduceus? C-A-D-U-C-E-U-S. What is it?
The angel with the snakes.
Yeah, it's not really an angel, but I could see why you might picture it that way. It is the medical insignia. And if you break it down, it is a staff or a rod with a golden ball at the top. There are wings, so it kind of looks a little like an angel. And then what else is on it?
Two snakes.
Two snakes facing each other, correct? Does anybody have a sense? Yeah, intertwined, right. So does anybody have a sense of what that has to do with medicine? Now, I want you to know, I pose this question to doctors and I get the same response I just got. So, but think about it. I mean, we accept it, right? If I showed it to you, I go, what is this? You go, oh, it's the medical thing. It's the medical logo, right? It's the medical insignia. But you never really stopped and thought about, what does medicine have to do with snakes? Why are they wrapped around a rod? What does this mean? I mean, if it were a hypodermic needle, that would make more sense, right? Or even if it were a hypodermic needle wrapped in a gauze bandage, you go, okay, I get that. But why a rod with a golden ball with two snakes? Can anybody even fathom a guess? Or is it so far out of the realm of what you can even perceive that you just have to go, I don't really know. That's sort of bizarre.
What is the question?
Is there anybody here who doesn't know what I'm talking about, who can't envision it? Okay, good. So everybody knows what I'm talking about, but nobody really knows what it has to do with medicine. I'm going to give you a little bit of background, and I want you to think carefully about this. The first reference, there are two kind of two versions of this. One has one snake, and another, which is the more familiar one, has two. So the first reference of a rod with a ball at the top and a snake around it, it's biblical. It comes from Exodus. And when Moses led people through the desert, somehow miraculously, there was provision. There was provision of food and there was provision of water. But there were also dangers in the desert. And one of the dangers, or representative of the many dangers, was the idea of a venomous snake. There are venomous snakes that live in the desert. So Moses had a rod with a snake around it. And when somebody was in danger of death because of a danger in the desert, they would look to this rod, and the globe at the top represented God being higher than any earthly snake. And they would get well. So this is the first reference of this staff with a snake wrapped around it. Now, for generations after Moses, this existed. And finally, there was a king who found the people coming from far and wide to kneel at the foot of this staff. And he decided they're kind of missing the point. You know, guys, it's not about this thing that Moses held. It's really about God. So he destroyed it. Now, years later, in Greece, Asclepius became the first physician of record. Asclepius was an ancestor of Hippocrates, and all doctors take the Hippocratic Oath. So now you're seeing there's a progression that's leading this forward. Asclepius was the first physician on record. He healed using various modalities, but he believed that there was a healing power in a specific type of snake. And today, if you went into a pet shop or to a reptile collector, it's called a rat snake. But the Greek name actually has Asclepius in it. It is the snake of Asclepius. And he would build these temples where people would come to get well, and there were these snakes that were not venomous and were very easily tamed. So he carried a rod that looked very much like the one described in the Bible, and it was a staff with a snake. Over time, Asclepius was revered or elevated to a god, the god of medicine, in Greek mythology. And Asclepius had two daughters. One was Panacea, and one was Hygieia. Panacea was the goddess of interventions, of surgery, of herbal cures, of giving the body something external to fix it. Hygieia was what we might call the goddess of wellness. Healthy movement, healthy food, clean water, relaxation, meditation, exercise. So when we look at medicine at its root, referring to the first physician, the god of medicine, according to Greek mythology, there were two pieces of it, Hygieia and Panacea. And if we look at medicine today, it seems they forgot Hygieia. It's all about the intervention. It's all about the cure. It's all about the surgery. It's all about the drug. And I think that's a part of where you guys get resentful, because you understand this, remove the interference and the body innately will get well. Doctors don't operate that way. So is there room for both? Sure. Do you see it that way? Yeah. But you get frustrated because conventional medicine doesn't. Now we're going to go further back, and we're going to look at Hermes. Hermes was also from mythology, elevated to be a god. But Hermes was a great wise philosopher and teacher thousands of years ago. And Hermes, you might have heard of Hermetic medicine or Hermetic thought. Hermes carried a staff with two snakes. And this is actually called the staff or the rod of Hermes.
Hello.
Whoever just answered the phone, if you could hit star six, that would be great. Just mute. If you can picture the staff, there's a snake on the right and a snake on the left, and they are kind of like mirror image, but they're not really mirror image because they're intertwining. If it were a mirror, they couldn't touch. So you have two identical snakes facing each other and intertwining. The staff of Hermes on the right represents divine man. What does that mean? It means the potential of man. It means in man's potential to exist, before man comes to exist, in his potential to exist, there is perfection. The opposite snake represents what we would call earthly man, the manifestation of man. So we have two snakes. One would be the potential of man to be near perfect.
Thank you so much,
Bill. The other being the man as he really exists. So the intention of wellness, of medicine at its deepest core, is to bring man, and of course this would apply to women too, but bring man to his greatest potential. Because if the potential is divine health, if the potential is perfect health, then this representation is the great healer can take the earthly man and remove bruises and maladies and aberrations and bring the actual manifestation back to perfection. So it does become, in a sense, a mirror. So healing means bringing man to his greatest potential. Now, this is noble. If you're following this and buying into it, man, what a beautiful quest. What a beautiful way to look at this. You look at a person and you go, I see you as you are, but I also see you as you can be. And my goal as your healer is to bring you to where you can be, to restore the innate health that is potentially within you, to bring it to the surface to make it real. So my question is now, if this is the intention of the insignia, if this is the root of the insignia that has carried forward through generations, is conventional medicine doing that? Or have I lost you completely? I mean, and be honest, if I went off on a philosophical rant and you just kind of scratch your head going, what is he talking about? You know, I'm okay with that. See, and as Sarah said, they talk at the beginning of the call and then they stop.
Obviously, they have not reached that potential.
Well, they haven't reached it, but are they even pursuing it? Like, when you look at that, does it even
resemble... I
don't think
they're pursuing it at all.
Is it even close? Is it anywhere close to what medicine does?
No.
Well, they have the panacea part.
They have the panacea part. But in terms of understanding that there is a divine potential, and they're looking at a person and asking the question, how can I bring you to your ultimate potential? How can I bring you to your best? That's never really addressed in giving them a prescription, is it?
No.
So who is really better equipped to meet this intention, you or the conventional doctor?
Obviously us.
Obviously you. And this is why it does become frustrating that you need to go, not that you shouldn't, but that you need to go to places like these seminars to reconnect, to find other like-minded people, because this should be the thread that runs through all of it. This should be the pursuit. An individual comes to you because they have need. Through speaking to them and examining them, you assess what you believe to be their greatest potential, and your goal becomes to move them there. How beautiful is that? Imagine if you really did that for every single patient. Now, I believe that you all have stories about times you did that without knowing what I just spoke about. I would guess most doctors don't have those stories. They're going to go, yeah, she came in with a rash, and I gave her a cream, and she doesn't have the rash anymore. It's not quite elevating somebody to their divine potential. So just consider this when really assessing your value. If you really have this intention, then don't you deserve to be paid in line with that intention? Especially if you can deliver on bringing people closer to their greatest potential. Now, what else is interesting is if you look carefully at that logo, the snakes intertwine seven times. There are seven times they meet. Now that you understand that this comes from thousands and thousands of years ago, it's really interesting that it resembles the DNA strand. It's almost as if there's something prophetic. And we also now know that we can change the expression of our DNA, which we didn't know 20 years ago or less than that. And still, most doctors don't operate that way. So I think it's vitally important that you guys have a way to insulate. Meaning that although you'll go to a seminar every 6 months, what about when you're not at the seminar? I want you to have the belief. I want you to have the knowledge. I want you to have your value. I don't want it to change, even if there are distractions. I don't want you to struggle with the thought of asking for the money you deserve. I don't want you to any longer have to resent the doctor. I want you to realize you're closer to the intention of medicine than that doctor. And that doesn't mean there aren't doctors who operate this way, but proportionally they're few and far between. So at some point, you've got to take ownership of this. At some point, you've got to stop the need for the booster shot. Still go, but you've got to stop the need. You just have to start to operate now in that belief system that you are worth it. And because you're worth it, you deserve not only to ask for it, but to command it. Because you know that you have an ability to restore people to health and in many cases bring them close, if not all the way up, to their divine potential. When with conventional medicine, there is no hope of that. I don't know if I mentioned this on the last call, but I know somebody, a friend of my parents, and she recently lost her husband. They've been married for 50 years. So, needless to say, she's sad. Now, I believe that's a natural emotion when you lose somebody you've been married to. So she went to the doctor, and the doctor said, we're going to put you on some Lexapro. And I think that's appropriate. I think if she's having trouble functioning, because she can't snap herself out of the sadness, maybe that's a time for panacea. But here's what's upsetting. The doctor said, now this is going to work for a while, and then we'll probably have to switch it to a different medication. Why is that upsetting? Because there's this assumption that she'll always need medication. Why? There's this label that now you are depressed, as if you are a depressed person. You are no longer the person you were. You are now a depressed person. When the reality is, she's a person who went through tragedy and is going through normal grief. But the assumption that she'll always need to be on medication, I think that's moving away from the deepest intention of medicine. That's saying, let's get you hooked on this. Is it a fix? No. It's almost the zombification of people who go through tragedy. We're going to now bring you into a state where you can no longer function without medication. And here's a new label. You are depressed. From now on, you are depressed. You used to be a person. Now you're depressed. Oh, and by the way, you're hypothyroid too. Here's a second label, just in case the first one falls off. All the more reason for you to be depressed. So I'm going to talk today about a ritual, and I know it's easy to dismiss it. I know it's easy to think this is silly. I'm going to ask you to do something by yourself in your home, and it's easy not to. You wake up, you get out of bed, the kids need breakfast, you got to take care of something, you got lots of texts, you got to check your email. It's easy not to. But I want to tell you, when you do the ritual long enough can be 3 weeks, you change your neural wiring, which you now understand, so that many of the things that you need to go to a seminar for operate on automatic pilot. You have the confidence. You have the belief. Sure, you want to be around like-minded people, but you don't need to reinforce your value. You just know. And whatever aspirations, whatever outcomes you set for yourself, you shouldn't question them anymore. So although the ritual may seem obscure or silly, it changes the wiring in your brain, and it really does give you a sense of control. Now, I want to give you a heads up. Our next call is our last call in this Be Better group. And on the next call, and Sarah, I want to follow through on what we did with the last group, because I enjoyed it. I think they did. We're going to have some options, but I would like at least five of you to participate openly on the next call. So I would ask you to literally make a reservation with Sarah. Just contact Sarah and say, I'd like to do one of these things, and I'll tell you what the things are. On the last call, the next one, the call might literally be 5 minutes. We might go 5 minutes, nobody wants to participate, and then I'm going to go, guys, I love you, have a great rest of the year, and enjoy being better, and good luck to everybody, bye. I mean, that might happen if you guys aren't willing to participate. Or it might go 95 minutes or even 2 hours. It's up to you. It's up to your participation.
Last one was long.
Yeah.
Last group was pretty long. Right?
Yeah, and I believe this group is going to be stronger.
Yeah, definitely.
And fun, right? I mean, that was a good, memorable call.
That was the best call. Definitely one of the best calls. It's not the best call.
So here's what I'm going to ask for the next call. And by the way, we will keep this discussion group active for 45 days after the call. So you can continue to interact and follow through on all of the directives and catch up. But number one, somebody is going to choose to be in the hot seat. So here's how the hot seat works. You openly share a challenge or a problem, and you let me question you enough. You have to be totally transparent so we really understand it. And then the members of the group offer advice and direction. The value of this, if you're willing to put yourself out there, is 10 times what you've invested in this program, honestly. So if you really have a nagging problem or a deep problem or a true challenge, it is your peers bringing their wisdom for you. So I'll say this, if I were in the group, I would jump on the hot seat. Okay, so just know that. That's one offer. Secondly, I want one person to share an anecdote, just a story from your own life or your own experience, a story, but it has to evoke emotion, and there has to be a lesson that will benefit the people in this group. So if you have an anecdote, a story just from your own life, something you've learned, something you've been through. And when I say emotion, you know, this is something really interesting. And I don't know why. This has just been my observation. But when I do exercises and I ask for something emotional, women usually pick a sad emotion. And men usually pick a happier, not necessarily a joy, but just like a kind of a victorious emotion, just something I've happened to notice. So I'm just telling you, wide open, whatever emotion, but I want you, somebody, to be able to share a story where everybody's going to connect, but there's also a lesson that people will walk away with. Third, the sharing of any principle that we covered in all of the time we've spent together, any principle at all, and a mention of either how it impacted you. Or you can choose the flip side. You can say, because you neglected to implement it, you're now ready to optimize it. In other words, if you want to talk about the monsters and the heroes, you can say, you know, let me tell you a story about what the monsters actually did to me over the last 8 weeks, but now I'm going to sum it up the heroes. So any principle that we discussed, the life cycle of business, being in prime, anyone. So that's three. Hot seat, emotional anecdote, the sharing of a principle. Number four. And again, I want one person to make a reservation for each of these so we know going into the call who's going to do each one. Number four, a bold statement. A bold statement telling us with certainty where you will be, when you'll be there, and how you know it will happen. It's got to be specific. It can't be, I'm going to make a little more money. It can't be, I'm going to raise my rate. Something very specific. When I say bold, I mean bold. Remember me telling you the story of Joe Namath. Guaranteed a win. I want that kind of certainty. Or number five, we're going to go 2 weeks before we speak again. I'm going to give you a ritual today. So number five, the fifth option would be you're willing to give yourself fully to this ritual, to literally do it every day, and you will report as to the change it brought about. So those are the five options. So Sarah, you will, by next week, have a list, right?
Yep, yep.
Oh, okay, so... Ritual. What is he talking about, ritual? And, you know, sometimes you hear ritual and it has some negative connotations. You might be, oh, I don't want to do any kind of ritual. That's a little creepy. No, we actually embrace rituals. Some football team's fans have rituals. I've been foolish enough to go to other cities to watch the Jets play, and I've been subjected to the rituals. I faced the terrible towels in Pittsburgh years ago. In Cleveland, in the AFC Championship, I don't remember what year it was, I got nailed by dog bones from the dog pound. It's a ritual, the dog pound. They bark in Cleveland. Does it make sense rationally? No, but it's a bonding thing, very much like you guys say, you want to be around like-minded people. The Cleveland Browns fans like to be around people who bark. Does it make sense? No. But it's some human connection, very much like putting cheese on your head. I mean, there have been times in Naples, Florida, for some reason, there's a lot of people from Wisconsin. So if you go to a sports bar on a Sunday, they're sitting there with their cheese heads. Now, it looks bizarre. In Naples, Florida, there's four people sitting in the bar wearing cheese on their heads. But in Wisconsin, in Green Bay, it's a ritual. So we do embrace rituals as something bonding about them. We're all subject to them. You can pretend as much as you want to be such a strong individual, there are no rituals, but you're subject to it just as all of us. They're a part of human bonding. At an independent level, they actually contribute to our confidence, as irrational as that may be. Think about what's coming up in a week or two. Thanksgiving dinner. None of us have ever met a pilgrim. So what do? Well, we get a turkey. Why? Because it's a ritual. And what else do? We invite extended family to our house. Sometimes we don't even like them. We can't wait till they leave sometimes. And we overeat. And people plop down on the couch and fall asleep, and they go, it's the turkey enzyme. Heard that for years. It's tryptophan, the turkey enzyme. I don't know who named it the turkey enzyme, but for some reason, this is what people believe it to be. As a population, We expect the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. We expect people to walk down the street in New York City, down Fifth Avenue, with massive balloons that look like Mickey Mouse. Does it make any sense? No, it's just a ritual. We also rely on football games being on television. And not only do we rely on that, so too do advertisers and retailers, because they take it into the next day. They make the following day one of the busiest shopping days of the year for no rational reason. We're only in November, but they make it the unofficial opening of the Christmas shopping season, Black Friday. Because it makes sense? No, because it's just a ritual. So these are bonding rituals. So we can complain about them. I know everybody complains about Black Friday, but people are crazy enough to go. I never would, but I know people stay overnight at the mall, trample each other in the morning, and then they complain about everyone else not realizing they're in the ritual. The Thanksgiving dinner itself is ritualized. It's turkey, stuffing, dressing, cranberry sauce, cornbread, sweet potato, yams, what else? Green beans. And then pumpkin or pecan pie or both. Now, each family has its own variation on the ritual, but they hold tight to that ritual. So bonding, as I mentioned, is one way that ritual serves us, but it's not the only way. It's not only about other people. Sometimes it's a relationship between you and yourself. It has nothing to do with rational thought. So if the voice in your head is going, this is dumb, I'm not doing the ritual, you got to shut that voice up because that's the rational voice. That's the EEM. Just tell it to shut up. It has everything to do with neural wiring and programming. When the baseball pitcher, before his windup, spits, he's wired in that ritual. Maybe it ultimately becomes a superstition, but it simply became wired into his mind. It doesn't require any thought. And if you're ever off on your ritual once it's wired in, your EEM senses danger. Not enough to throw you into fight or flight, but mildly. You don't panic, but it just feels like something's off. If in the morning before you leave your house, you say a prayer, and then you're halfway at work and you realize you forgot to say the prayer, you start to feel like your day is going to be off, to the point that some people even drive around, go back home, say the prayer, and then be late for work, because they've wired in the ritual. When I drive my daughter to school, as soon as we get off I-95 on 45th, she plays a Fall Out Boy song on her phone, or 21 Pilots. She's now progressed in her ritual, but she plays a song either by Fall Out Boy or 21 Pilots. She takes over the Bluetooth, and then she texts her mom. When her mom drives her to school, it's the reverse. She puts on a song by Fall Out Boy or 21 Pilots, and then she texts me. It's a ritual. 7:50 every morning, I get the text, or her mom gets the text. Does anybody here have a routine upon waking? Just a routine, even if it's the order with which you shave, brush your teeth, get dressed. You don't have to share what your ritual is, but just tell me, does anybody here have a ritual when you go, yeah, I kind of do things the same way every single day?
Lots of things I do the same way.
I have a good friend, who I will politely say she's mildly obsessive, slightly obsessive. I am being polite. All the labels in her pantry face the exact same way. And the right things are on the right shelves. And if she ever opens the pantry in my house, she has to close it immediately. So she's a little bit obsessive, if you can be that. And she lives right near Fort Lauderdale Airport. So when I have an early flight, because I live about 45 minutes from the airport, so when I have like a 6 a.m. flight, I stay at her house. So in the morning, I can just roll out of bed and get right there. So she always offers to drive me. And I always say it's not necessary. I could take my own car. I could jump in an Uber. But she always wants to drive me, which is nice. So she's got to get up before me. Why? Because in the morning, she brushes her hair 100 times. And walks around the house brushing her teeth for 5 minutes with the electric toothbrush. Now, I don't know if it were me, if I were her husband, I'm not, it would make me crazy. Now, I don't know why. I'm sure her husband's fine with it. But this is her ritual. She brushes her hair 100 times. This is a grown woman, a successful woman. Brushes her hair 100 times and walks around the house with her electric toothbrush, brushing her teeth, because that's what I hear is the buzzing as she kind of walks by the room that I sleep in, brushing her teeth, and she has to do it for 5 minutes. She has a little timer on the toothbrush. And then, with hair brushed and teeth clean, she empties the dishwasher. Even if my flight is 6 o'clock in the morning, for some reason that dishwasher must be empty before she leaves the house. Now, on days that I'm not there, the ritual continues because we talk about it. So right after she empties the dishwasher, she makes a protein shake, and then she goes for a walk on her treadmill. When she drives me to the airport, she's always a little out of sorts because she has to get back to get on that treadmill. She has to make the protein shake. So it's a ritual. Is it rational? No. But it's what she's wired in. My ex-wife, before she'd go to bed, I mean, this was just a thing that I don't understand, but on our table, on our kitchen table, which always looked beautiful, there would be placemats and a centerpiece, always, except when we eat. So when we'd have a meal, she would take the centerpiece, she would put it on a separate counter, and then after, the table would be cleaned and the centerpiece would be back. A ritual. Doesn't make any sense. Nobody was coming in the middle of the night to look at our kitchen table. Nobody was going to come take pictures for a beautiful home magazine. Every night before she'd go to bed, she'd run the dishwasher, she'd put the centerpiece on the table. There was a blanket on the couch that when we'd sit and watch TV, she'd sit with the blanket. She'll fold the blanket, put it on the side of the couch, and turn the lights off in order, and then she'd go upstairs. There is one of my favorite gyms ever was the YMCA in Flushing, Queens. It was just a real hardcore gym. And everybody there was, you know, was there because they were serious, but there was also a great camaraderie. And there was this guy that used to come in there, and he was a little older, I guess maybe relative because I was much younger. But he'd come in, and he would always do squats, and before he'd squat, he'd chalk up the bar, and he wasn't a big guy. And he'd go, world's record, stop, 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 and then he would do the squats. Now, why? I don't know. And we asked him, why do you say stop? And he'd go, I don't say that. So maybe he was a little whacked out, but that was his ritual. Before every set. I could give you thousands of examples. But ritual is something we all engage in. It is a team event. But in sports, it also finds its way to individual sports. Serena Williams has a series of rituals. She always bounces the ball 5 times before her first serve. Go on YouTube and just pull up any game in which she played and you'll see. She bounces the ball 5 times before her first serve. Anyone have a ritual they want to share, or is anybody aware of one that they witness in someone else? I just want to make sure you guys are sort of connecting with this, because I know the word ritual sometimes puts people off until they understand. It's just sort of what we do habitually. Can anybody think of one in your own life, or maybe that you want to reveal your spouse does, or that a friend of yours does, or that you've witnessed with anybody who plays sports or participates in anything? Give me one example so I know we're connected here.
Phil, every time we start our day, we state our purpose, we sing the word subluxation to the tune of Mickey Mouse, and then we do something that's called the Mortar March from Best Technique, me and my team. I've set that up for years. Feels weird if we ever miss it.
Can we hear the subluxation song?
S-U-B-L-U-X-A-T-I-O-N, free.
So everybody does that. Nobody questions it. Right? Nobody goes,
no.
Why are we doing it? They just do it. It's become a ritual. And as you said, if you don't do it, and you'll acknowledge that it's silly, right?
Of course.
But if you don't do it, you just feel like something's off.
Yep.
Do you ever come in late and you can't get to it? Or you always do it no matter what?
I have never been late in 20 years, so I don't know.
So this ritual is very, very important. And I'm going to give you one today, and I just want you to treat it with that type of importance, not because you're going to think it through. You don't think about the silliness of the subluxation to the tune of Mickey Mouse. You just do it. Serena Williams doesn't think about bouncing the ball 5 times. You don't put any thought into it when you grab a towel when you get out of the shower, and you probably grab the towel from the same place. You probably sit on the couch in the same spot when you watch TV. It's a big couch, but you sit in that same spot. You probably choose the same chair at the kitchen table, even though you could choose any chair. When you drive to work, you probably go right to the same radio station. If you pay attention, you may be surprised to find out you probably put the same shoe on first every day. When you come home, hopefully you put your car keys in the same spot. It's a ritual. When you hear a certain song, a favorite song from a long time ago, your body moves in the same ritualistic way. How? I don't know. Different for everyone. You do a little dance with your shoulders, you mouth the words. What you say when someone sneezes is a ritual. There's no thought. You just do it. So these habitual repetitive actions become wired in. And if you remember the basic law of neuroplasticity, neurons that fire together wire together. I spoke at the beginning of the program. I reminded you last time about the four waves of change. At first, there's an old pathway that you want to interrupt, but it's very secure. That is EEM dominance. But you start to force a new behavior, or in this case, a ritual. And that leads you to the second wave, which is where you now have duality. You formed a new pathway. But it's easy to revert back to the old one. You still have to consciously do the ritual. The third wave, you now have PFC dominance. The new pathway is becoming stronger. But in times of stress, you'll skip the ritual because it's not fully wired in yet and that old pathway still exists. The fourth wave is erasure. The old pathway goes away. And that's where Ray is at with his morning ritual. There's not even an option. It's just what he does every single day. Now remember, your brain doesn't know the difference between an experience that is perceived through the five senses or an imagined experience that the mind creates using multisensory cues. So in order to perform this daily ritual every day for the next 2 weeks, you need two things. One, a sense of where you're stuck. If you remember creative tension, the circle is where you are now and what you want to change. So whatever that circle is for you now, in order to do this ritual, you've got to get really clear on where you're stuck. You've got to get really clear on what you want to change or what in your life that you know is changeable brings you a level of discontent. You've got to start with that state of discontent. And it becomes even more valuable if you can identify the monsters or the thoughts that keep you stuck. So you need that. Before you can do the ritual, you've got to get really connected to where in your life you want change. Everything that we've done up until now can be integrated into this ritual. I said you need two things. That's the first. The second is a clear vision, a crystallized vision with sound, emotion, sensation. A clear, crystallized vision of an ideal, of where you really want to be, of the outcome you want. Now, we've spoken about this concept of creative tension on and on and on, again and again and again and again. Now it's time to turn it into something that you're going to literally wire into your brain so the change happens. There are the two ends of your creative tension line, where you are and where you want to be. And the daily ritual is going to take you along that line. In order to do this effectively, you want to literally identify two spots on your floor, one representing the circle, one representing the rectangle. What I mean is you're going to stand in the circle. Now, there doesn't have to be a real circle on the floor. I'm not asking you to get chalk and draw on the floor. But in your mind, you're going to envision this creative tension line, and the circle represents where you are now. So you're going to literally stand there. And by the end of the ritual, you're going to be standing at the other end of the creative tension line. So you've got to identify two distinctive spots on your floor, one representing the discontent of now, the other representing the bliss of where you want to be. And they should be several feet from each other. The idea is to use senses and emotion together. Now, I'm going to tell you, this is a neurological shortcut of a very powerful change strategy that I share with people to make radical changes in their behaviors and their lives. Once you embrace it and experience it, you may find you use it with patience. Until you do it yourself, don't experiment on other people, because you've got to experience it to really understand its value. And you also need to do this uninterrupted. So you have to tell your spouse, your kids, that for this short period in the morning, don't bother you no matter what. You cannot be interrupted. Toilet's overflowing, you'll deal with it when you finish your ritual. Big rat in the kitchen, you'll deal with it later. Very important text from Donald Trump, you'll deal with it after your ritual. You need to be uninterrupted. So if your spouse will be in the room, he or she really has to buy in. They have to understand what you're doing. In fact, if you have a very progressive spouse, he or she can even be a facilitator or can follow your ritual with one for something that he or she wants to change. But you have to have complete buy-in. You cannot have a detractor. The negative talk monster has to be locked in the basement. Or if you don't have a basement, just underground somewhere or sent into a cave. Okay, the ritual goes like this. Stop, stop, stop. Now let me tell you what you're stopping. You're stopping the negativity. So you're standing in the spot that represents the discontent of where you are now. This is real. This is not fake. So if you just don't love the house you live in, if it really bothers you what you're charging at work, if you don't like your present office, if you just feel like your life is ruled by other things and you want to take charge, whatever it is, if you want to lose 20 pounds and you're really frustrated that you speak of it but you don't do it yourself, if you hate the car you drive because even though it makes financial sense, you don't like what it represents, whatever it is, nobody's going to judge it. This is entirely between you and you. If you hate all the hours that you have to work, even though you love what you do, or if you don't love what you do anymore because you work too many hours, you're going to stand in it. You're going to literally stand in it. It's like you're bathing in it. Now, sometimes when people hear me talk about this, they go, I don't want to do that because it feels negative. I'm not asking you to feel negative. I'm asking you to feel reality. I'm asking you to choose an element of your life that you want to change. I'm not asking you to imagine negativity. I'm just saying choose an area in your life that you want to change. And if you want to change it, the greatest way to propel yourself out of this stuck circle is to light a fire, the fire of discontent. And if you want to feel discontent, then you have to acknowledge that it doesn't feel good to be there. So if you're standing in your circle going, I don't make enough money, but it's okay because I really help people, this is not going to work for you. You've got to really confront whatever it is that you want to change. Will it feel heavy? Yeah. You want it to. And don't fear it, because the beauty of it is you're going to escape it in a second. You're not in that any longer. You're in that for seconds every morning, and then you're freeing yourself of it completely. So it's not a little nagging thing that happens all day long. So you're standing in your circle, eyes closed, literally feeling the burden of whatever it is that you want to change. There will be a tendency to want to reassure yourself, to want to go, but it's not that bad. But as soon as you do that, you weaken the ritual. So you've literally got to stand in your discontent. At first, it will be hard. Your own inner voice will distract you. But stay with it every day. You're changing your wiring, and it becomes as ingrained as singing the subluxation song to Mickey Mouse. So at first, you really have to force this. And you're going to do it. You're going to stand there, and you're going to go, all right, I'm unhappy with the money I'm making, and uh-oh, did I forget to let the dog out? And as soon as you do that, you weaken it. But understand, that's the beginning of training your mind to do this ritual, because it's new. And this is why you need to do it every single day. So when the emotion becomes real, when you're actually standing in it, and you're feeling it, and many of you will feel a physical change. You may feel your heart rate speed up. You might find a tear comes to your eye. Don't fear that. Go with it. Be in it. Because this is your body's survival. This is your body's way of saying, I'm now acknowledging this so I can escape it and get to somewhere better. So when you're in it, you take your hands and you put them as if you're saying to somebody in front of you, stop, as if you're trying to stop a car in front of you, both hands, with your eyes closed, you feel the intensity of the emotion, and you go, stop, stop, stop. And you don't yell it and you don't say it with anger, but it's literally like you're stopping the action in your head. Really what you're doing is short-circuiting the emotion. So you're starting to run this old program because you run it all the time. You just run it underneath everything else. It's like, you know, on your phone when you have a program open but you're not using it, the program's still running, draining the battery. So you're just bringing it to the front. You're like clicking on it. And then you're going stop, stop, stop. It's like you're just turning off that program. And then you're going to say, I am stuck. Now this is important because you're acknowledging that this is not the result of anything other than the fact that you've stayed here. This is not an excuse. This is not a justification. This is not a blame. This is not a pointing of the finger. This is not blaming anybody. It's just an acknowledgement that you've been stuck. So stop, stop, stop. I am stuck. And now you get unstuck. So when I said you don't blame anybody, you don't. But you truly go to the source. You know how the first R is we've got to remove the source. We're going to get right to the source here. What is the source? The source is cross-wiring in your limbic system. That's what it is. Your brain has linked emotions in a way that it's kept you stuck. So by doing this, you're removing any tendency to want to blame some other person or some other circumstance, and you're not feeling guilt because you're not saying, I did it to myself. You're acknowledging that your wires have become crossed and you're going to change it. So the full statement is, stop, stop, stop. I am stuck only because of cross-wiring in my limbic system. Please trust that I have done this hundreds of times, and you will not believe how powerful it is if you do this for 2 weeks. Stop, stop, stop. I am stuck only because of cross-wiring in my limbic system. Now we're going to make it a little bit stronger. So as soon as you say stop, 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 you are taking a step into mud. What do I mean into mud? Well, you want the sensation of being stuck, but more importantly, you want to feel the power of being unstuck. So you're standing in your circle, you put your hands up, stop, stop, stop. And as soon as you say stop, 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 you take a step toward your rectangle, not a big step, but a step out of the circle, and you're stepping into mud. Do you need to put real mud in your bedroom? No, you need to just trust your imagination here. So you're stepping toward the rectangle into mud, but I want you to pause and feel a bright light shining on you. And then you say, I am stuck only because of cross-wiring in my limbic system. Now, when you say this, I want your arms crossed in front of you. I am stuck only because of cross-wiring in my limbic system. You're saying this with your arms crossed in front of you. If you ever watch America's Got Talent, you know where they don't like an act and they cross their arms like to make an X? That's what you want to do. So you're in your circle. Stop, stop, stop. You take a step out of the circle into the mud, bright light shining on you. Your arms are crossed. I'm stuck only because of cross-wiring in my limbic system. And then you say, and I choose to rewire. And as you say that, you uncross your arms. Physiology leads the brain. By uncrossing your arms, your brain is literally getting the signal that you're making a change. A change where? In your limbic system. You are changing the wiring. Let me get a comment from somebody here before I go on. And be honest. Are you listening to this going, yeah, that doesn't really make sense, but I'm willing to try it? Or are you just going, there's just no way. This is just ridiculous and hokey and silly. Or is it making sense? Somebody, just give me honesty before I go on.
It sounds hokey, but it also makes sense. Because I understand how the limbic system works.
Yes. It sounds hokey because your rational brain doesn't like it. Your EM doesn't want you to change. That's a part of you being stuck. Does it sound hokey to sing subluxation to the tune of Mickey Mouse? But Ray knows it's effective for whatever reason. He doesn't have to rationalize it or justify it. He knows it brings him a better day, so he's going to keep doing it. Now, when somebody starts working for him, if they're there the first day, you know, show up at 9 o'clock and they get to work and they're singing S-U-B-L-E, they're going to go, well, what did I get myself into? What is this, kindergarten? But a week later, they'll be singing along.
Exactly
so
the
good.
Way it goes.
What's that?
That's exactly the way it goes.
Yeah. So even though it sounds hokey, I want you to challenge that. And I appreciate your honesty. Stop, stop, stop. You step toward the rectangle into the mud. You feel a bright light shining on you. I am stuck only because of cross-wiring in my limbic system. And then you uncross your arms and you say, and I choose to rewire. This is a beautiful statement. You're telling your limbic system you have a choice. By saying I choose to rewire, your limbic system must accept that you are no longer stuck. And then you step out of the mud. Now remember, this is not real mud, but in your mind, you're stepping out of the mud toward the rectangle. And you will follow with a present-based affirmation, an I am statement. You create the statement. It can be, I am powerful. I am confident. It can be, I am living the dream. This is creating the new pathway in your brain. And then you take one final step into the rectangle. So understand there are a few stops along the way. You step out of the circle into the mud. Then you uncross and you step out of the mud closer to the rectangle and you're making an I am statement. You're taking ownership. You're giving yourself an identity of power. And then you step into the rectangle. So what you've done in your mind is you've now stepped into the future. And start to picture it. Now, when we do this in workshops, people describe it out loud. And there's a real benefit to that. So even if you're by yourself, I would encourage you to say it out loud. There's somebody in the group who is very unhappy with her home in the Platinum Group. And we did this exercise at a little bit of a retreat. And she pictured her new home and she described it. And sure enough, she's now living in that home. So that's how powerful this can be. Many have done it with their income. So the more real you can make the imagery, the more your brain accepts it with certainty. So if you're willing to do this, you step into the rectangle and you describe out loud what you're seeing, what you're feeling, what you're experiencing, because you've literally stepped into your own imagery, into the future. When you speak it, you hear your own voice, and it creates a loop. You hear it, so you think it. You think it, you speak it. You speak it, you hear it. You feel, you think, you speak, you hear. You feel, you think, and all of that works to cement the new pathway. And you stay in it, raising the intensity of the positive emotion. How does it feel to be where you want to be? Because in this moment, you're envisioning it as if it's real. And if you can give the emotion color, then feel it literally wash over you. Feel that color enter you. Feel it surround you. And when you're at a peak of emotion, you literally scream with joy. Or what I have people do in workshops, they say burst into your 8-second celebration dance, and everybody has a good laugh. But it's like you just have to be so in this joy that you need to respond to it. So it can't just be like a clap your hands and you move on with your day. There has to be a literal celebration, a scream of joy, your little celebration dance, or just express with your body and mind how fantastic in the outcome you just imagined your life has become. That's the ritual. Do it every day until our next call. Let me hear either affirmations that you're going to do it or reasons why you're not.
I'll do it, Phil.
Why?
Because you told me to.
Okay, I'll accept that for now. I'll accept that.
Right, well,
now.
based upon what you're telling us, part of me is why not? And if there's something you do want to break through, and this is going to help you break through, great. I do have a question, and I can ask it later because I don't want to stop anybody else's flow.
No, ask it now. Ask it now.
So, I was listening and all that. Let's say you said, lose weight, car. You gave examples. You're not focusing on that. You're focusing on the outcome at the end, right? You're not, when you stop, you're just saying it. You're not thinking about your issue or whatever
you're leaving the issue. You're leaving it. When you say stop, you're turning the channel on the remote control. You're changing it. You're no longer in that. You've stepped out of it.
Okay. So you're thinking about that right before you say stop.
Correct.
Okay.
You're thinking about it in a way that you literally feel consumed by it, almost like you're standing under a cloud. And again, this is not you being negative. This is you acknowledging the discontent of what you want to get rid of. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So as soon as you say stop, that cloud is gone. You're stepping out from under it. Now, you're in mud because your brain has to sense that you didn't really make the change yet, but you feel the bright light because there's a sense of new possibility. That's the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is that light. So you've stepped out of the control of your EEM. You're standing in mud for a moment, and now you're acknowledging. You're saying, I'm stuck. I'm stuck in this moment, but only because of cross-wiring my limbic system. And then, wham, you just uncross it, and now you step the next step. And you go, I am powerful, strong, and confident. I radiate health and beauty in body and mind, whatever you're going to say. And then you step into the future, and now there's no acknowledgement of what was. This is pure the joy of you've stepped into the future. And you need to feel it, and you need to see it, and you need to talk about it. And the people who will be there, put them there. The sounds you will hear, put them there. If your kids are there and they're laughing, hear the kids laughing. If the wind is blowing, if you hear the ocean. So this has no longer anything to do with that circle. You've left it behind. So your mind has accepted that that's history now. The only thing that has to happen is the outcome that you've created just has to manifest. But it's no longer a question. Your brain accepted that you are capable of getting unstuck and moving into this new future. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Good. Good. Anyone else? Any questions, or just tell me why you're willing to do it, or why not?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm going to do it. And one of the reasons, or the reason, is because I've been looking recently at subconscious programs and how to rewrite them and working on that, because I feel like even through this program and through everything else, I consciously tell myself a lot of really good things, but things aren't really changing. And so I know there's some subconscious, like you said, wiring's crossed, and I'm not being able to break through it. So I've been looking for a way to rewire my subconscious, and this is perfect.
Beautiful. And let me tell you this. Many roads lead to the same place. So you could probably go through Gestalt therapy, where they have you beat up your pillow, and Freudian therapy, where you realize your deep feelings about your mother. And you can go through 20 years of therapy to land in the place where your subconscious accepts a new possibility. This is almost the technology of the brain that happens during that change. And the beauty of it is, if you access that technology, you make it happen in a matter of weeks as opposed to 20 years. So, yeah, and I think the conventional path is just the very slow and painful path. But if you can bring about that limbic system shift and your beliefs change, your subconscious thoughts change, and then so too do your behaviors and, of course, your outcomes. So that's a perfect answer. I appreciate that. Can I get one more thought respective to this ritual? I saved it until now, until we get to the end of the program, because everything that you did thus far plays into it. Everything you did in terms of reexamining your value and thinking of your true potential and getting unstuck and moving toward prime and what does prime really look like and nudging the needle and one more pizza, all of that now just becomes material that you're going to write the script for your future. One more. Just person, tell me either, no, Phil, I'm not going to do it, and here's why, or, yeah, I'm going to do it, and let me tell you the reason.
Hi, Phil.
Hi.
This is Melanie.
I know.
I'm going to try to do it. And the reason I say that is, being honest, it's been very difficult to do a lot of the directives throughout the program. because I'm so, I guess, all over the place. And I've still had a hard time, you know, getting a hold of that. So
okay.
Tell me
a ritual that you do, any ritual, you know, when you get out of bed, any ritual that you do, that every day or every week or whenever it is, every time you show up somewhere, you do the same thing. Can you think of one?
I go to the gym every morning at between 5 and 6.
Okay, what time do you leave your house?
It's your Friday.
What time do you leave your house?
Usually by 5:30.
And when you get to the gym, do you have a ritual?
I do. We're transitioning my practice to electronic health records, so I bring my iPad and I'm walking on the Stairmaster, putting in patient information.
Okay, and then what? Do you do any weights or resistance training or anything else, or it's just that?
If I get all my patient traps in, then I'll do some weights and resistance training.
What would happen if you didn't get on that Stairmaster for 2 weeks? You would lose your mind?
Not really. Actually, one of the reasons why I started going is because I realized I was sitting at my computer at home just putting in patient information, and it was just as easy for me to enter them while I'm doing some exercise, so I decided I'd go to the gym and at least get some benefit out of it.
How long is the drive from your house to the gym?
10 minutes.
Okay. You can do this ritual in that 10 minutes.
Okay.
Now, here's what you have to question. Here's what you have to question, and not now, but after we hang up. Might it be worth it? Might it be worth it? Because this is a part of the stuck, right? You get on the Stairmaster or whatever machine you're on. You're doing it mindlessly because your brain is somewhere else. And at the very least, it's making you feel okay because you're doing the exercise. But is it really bringing about change in your life? Now, keep in mind, you're talking to an exercise guy. My whole career has been motivating people to exercise. So if I'm saying this is more important than the exercise, just put a little credence in that and consider it. And if for the next 2 weeks you can just give this priority, knowing it'll take you 10 minutes, but you must do it at 5 in the morning. As soon as you get out of bed, just do it. The first day, you will fight with yourself. The second day, you'll fight with yourself. The third day, suddenly you'll go, you know, this is kind of okay. The fourth, fifth day, you're going to have a better day because of it. And if you can really hang in there, I'm not asking you to do it for the rest of your life. I'm asking you to do it for 2 weeks. I'm willing to put myself on the line to face the wrath of Melanie if you find that you became so deconditioned and overweight and you lost all of your aerobic capacity because of the 2 weeks you didn't get on the Stairmaster. I will own that. I will take full responsibility. But I have a feeling that's not what's going to happen. So you don't have to answer me. I just want you to consider that after the call. Okay? And thank you for being honest. I'm not forcing your hand. I'm respecting your honesty and giving you some perspective.
Thank you.
Okay. Should I go for one more, Sarah? Let me go for one more.
Yeah, absolutely. At least one more. I always say that. I bet there are a couple more in there.
Let's get one. We can't get a couple until we get one. Just one person tell me either why you're going to do it or why you're not.
Maybe they haven't decided.
No, then say that. I'll do it, of course.
I'm sorry, who is it? Ray?
This is Ray.
Yeah, you'll
do
it, of course.
I sing subluxation, so what the hell?
And who knows, you may even put this to the Donald Duck song. Okay, very good. So this, to me, is the transformational 2 weeks. This is it. This is when the change really happens. So we've covered a lot of ground. It wouldn't hurt if you can find the time to review some of the former directives, to take a look at the notes from the previous calls and zero in on where you think you might have needed the most. Because when you see the volume of material that we've covered, you're going to find it's immense. But it's also logical. It followed a pattern and it led us here. So do this ritual every day until our next call. If you need somebody to throw you a rope, just put on the discussion group, I need help, I'm not doing the ritual. Just try that. And as soon as you are ready or willing, just step up for our next call. Remember, I'll need one of the following from at least 5 people. 1, the hot seat. You share a challenge, problem, and the members of the group help. 2, an anecdote, a story that evokes emotion, and there should be a lesson attached to it. 3, the sharing of any principle at all that we covered, anyone, the reach, the funnel, the spillover, anything, and either talk about how it impacted you or how, based on the fact that you neglected it, you're now ready to use it. Number four, a bold statement telling us where you'll be, when you'll be there, and how you know it will happen. And number five, this needs to come from somebody who's committed. Tell us about the simple change that did or didn't take place after doing the ritual for 2 weeks. So you now have very, very simple tools for creating four ways of change. I'm suggesting that you go back and look at some of the notes, but I don't want you to just completely immerse yourself in it and get confused. I really want you to focus on the ritual, because you will see if you start to go back, we covered a lot more ground than you imagine. But it is a good week to recognize the power of the following strategies. One, gratitude. Write in your gratitude journal or speak the gratitude exercise aloud before bed. Going to bed in gratitude sends the monster called money worry and the monster called negative talk far away. And because you now have a ritual to perform in the morning, you don't want those monsters around. You also want to align your RAS, your focus, your reticular activating system, with your ideal future. You want to have fun creating your ideal future, but really have an awareness to it. Have a constant mental link to it. So here's where you have to call the heroes: clarity and focus. Lock in. Know the destination and see it as a certainty. You want to stimulate your PFC, your prefrontal cortex, to greater heights than ever by breaking out of some of your limits, by speaking to people you normally wouldn't, by at times risking making a fool of yourself just to make someone else laugh, by taking on a sport or an activity or an event that you normally wouldn't for fear of embarrassing yourself. The more you embrace uncharacteristic actions, especially with a willingness to laugh, the more you stimulate new wiring in your brain. So this is a good time to play. Every new action, if you emerge from it with safety — I certainly don't want you to do anything where you might get hurt — but any new action that comes with a hint of joy or laughter or happiness builds new reference points so that you can shut down the restrictive ability of your EEM. On the next call, you will share what I've asked you to. And then I have an interesting perspective on charity, and I think you'll all enjoy it and benefit from it. But before we leave today, I just want you to consider a question. Are you a leader? Now, leaders are also followers, because leaders go to seminars because they want to be around like-minded people. So now it's a seminar of leaders, yet there's somebody on the stage. So in essence, the leaders are followers. We all are individuals, but we're all part of a greater collective. So are you a leader? I don't know if you remember, I spoke about Niccolo Machiavelli, and he said that the human ape is a mimic, and we are wired to follow, yet some must lead. So when I say this, does it sit well with you? You are a leader. That statement scares most people. It summons up fear. And fear is the greatest weapon of the monsters. So are you a leader? Are you willing to admit or accept the responsibility of being a leader? Sometimes in seminars, I open up with a question. The question is, can we predict the future? And there are always two sides of the argument. You know, people raise their hand, they go, well, some people have psychic abilities and really they can see the future. And then the other side says, no, that's all bunk and nonsense and we all have free will, so what we do is unpredictable. But what we can predict are outcomes based on patterns. We know when Halley's Comet is coming because it follows a pattern. So it's predictable. We know when the moon will be full. We just had an incredible full moon just a couple of nights ago. And we knew it was coming because it follows a pattern. We know when the tide will be high. We can also safely predict that if people in America keep eating the way they're eating and the food companies keep doing what they're doing, we'll have no shortage of sick people looking for solutions. That we can predict. So to that degree, we can predict. But how about your future? Can you predict it? We know if you keep doing what you've been doing, if there hasn't been any change, then you're likely to keep getting what you're getting. And all of you, whether you've fully manifested yet or not, all of you know that it is within your power to be better. So here's a statement I want you to consider. It is easier to create your future than to predict it. I want to say it again. It is easier to create your future than to predict it. So if we're going to be completely honest, your world is your world, nobody else's. You decide if you're going to watch the news and get upset by every crime in your city, or by the election, or by every heartbreaking incident in the Middle East. If you make the choice to tune in fully to the news, then all of those elements are part of your world, and the monsters celebrate. If you spend time isolated with your phone and your computer and your tablet watching conspiracy videos on YouTube, then all those conspiracies become real. If you allow people who are disruptive into your life gets disrupted. If you spent downtime hanging out with money worry, then your financial hole gets deeper and debt becomes your reality. And if you sit around and wish or check your horoscope or open fortune cookies until you get the right one or determine that somehow things will change, then your future is random. But remember what I said. It's easier to create your future than predict it. And patterns help you predict outcomes. Choose your patterns. Choose your rituals. Choose your influences. I would much rather watch the show Geniuses with Stephen Hawking than Wheel of Fortune. I would much rather listen to music that inspires me than watch the award shows where everyone is concerned over what J-Lo is wearing. Everything that you choose to bring into your world of rituals works on your EEM, your RAS, and your PFC. And if you become caught in the noise, you have little or no control over your programming. So based on everything I've said, just because you're wired to follow doesn't mean you must. And if it's easier to create your future than predict it, then lead. You may not fully realize it yet, but you're different than you were 7 months ago. You have new skills, you have new thoughts, you have new wiring, you have new reference points. And with that, you're better equipped not only to steer your own life, but to guide others. And when you guide them to a destination that they might not have been willing to go, then it's fair to say you're leading. So why does the word leader summon up such fear? Because most people are wired to follow, and it's fear that prevents them from changing their wiring. So whatever reason you would have given me as to why you won't do the ritual, I can reframe it as fear. And it will not serve you. There is safety in following, because you could always blame somebody else. And there's safety for the ego. The ego will never be bruised because you'll say it was somebody else's fault. A bad decision, not your fault. A wrong turn, not your fault. So I want you to accept the word leader. I want you to truly be a leader. And if you're held back, know that there are four distinctive fears that cause the word leader to back people down. One is the fear of criticism. And I think you have the power and ability to reframe criticism, to see any critical statement as a star that guides you. That comes from Aristotle. Criticism may actually be the greatest vehicle in helping you establish self-awareness, in getting you past your ego, and in realizing what people really think, not what you think they should think, but what they really think. The second fear would be the fear of failure. The third would be a fear of making decisions. You know people like that. When we did the exercise, if you came up with a golden retriever, then you have this fear to some degree. And if you avoid making decisions, then you'll never really develop what we call that gut feeling. Malcolm Gladwell defines it as a blink, if you read that book. The people who are most adept at making good decisions are the people who make the most decisions. And in that, they make some bad ones, but leaders are willing to because everyone is a lesson. And fourth is the fear of responsibility. But be responsible for you. And if you're willing to take responsibility for you and you're doing the best things for you, and the people in your life are there by choice, yours or theirs, then don't you develop an ability to steer, an ability to be responsible? Responsibility is a gift. It isn't a burden. It means you are able to respond. It's a power. But you have to choose to accept it. And there is actually a fifth fear that emerges when we interview people about why they won't take a leadership role, and it's a fear of speaking, a fear of commanding a group, because they run the risk of appearing to be less than competent. And if you're willing to dismiss all of those fears and take some chances, you're going to see what you're really made of. So I'm not asking you to lead millions of people or even hundreds of people if you don't want to. I'm just asking you to take ownership of your future, take ownership of the lives you touch, and they will be many, and be willing to play a role in changing your universe and in changing your industry if you feel it needs change. If you were impacted at all by what I said about the example of the caduceus in medicine, then I would say the industry needs change. It needs leaders. Teach by doing and do by leading. As a leader, as you strive for a higher level of balance between the reach and the funnel and the spillover, you'll find that you have to work on finding a new degree of patience, a higher degree of tolerance. But with those lessons, you change. So I want you to not only do the ritual, but I want you to know that you have a power in that. And in your rectangle, you can put whatever you want, but I'm asking you to give yourself the advantage of seeing yourself as a leader. Any thoughts, comments, questions from any of the leaders? How about from any of the followers? How about from any of the wonderful people here? I'm fishing for at least one thought, comment, or question. I'm throwing the line out there. Just give me one. I don't want to be the guy who stands there all day with my pole in the water and gets nothing.
I think it's fantastic, Bill. I'm really excited.
All right, good. Thank you. I can now put my pole away and go on with my life. Anybody else? Any thoughts at all? Sarah, anything you want to say in wrapping it up and heading toward our final call 2 weeks from now?
I think that, you know, this ritual is, we had great results last time, and, I think everyone should go for it. And I'm really excited to hear. I'll check in with everyone in a week and see how they're doing. I've already gotten emails and text messages about spots for the call in 2 weeks, so it should be a really exciting call. And I just want to remind everyone that these calls will be up for 8 months after this program ends. So don't feel like, oh, I got to quickly catch up on everything else. Just focus on this call and what we talked about in this call, what Phil emphasized in this call for the next 2 weeks, and you'll have big changes in your life for sure.
Until we speak again, take care of your retinas, take care of your loved ones, and be better. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.